It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Culinary Institute of America has been setting the standard for excellence in the culinary profession since it was founded more than 70 years ago. Its longtime president, Tim Ryan, is a Pittsburgh native. Tim, welcome home. Welcome to the Confluence.
Thanks, Kevin. It's great to be here.
President of the Culinary Institute, I don't imagine that was necessarily the plan when you were a teenager in East Liberty.
Well, that's true. Originally, I wanted to be an attorney. I wanted to be an attorney, a lawyer. But then I started working in restaurants and became fascinated by that and decided I wanted to be a chef. And once I started to learn about chefs, then I wanted to be the greatest chef in the world, who at the time was a Frenchman by the name of Paul Bocuse. But I figured that somewhere other than Pittsburgh, I needed to learn how to be the greatest chef in the world. And I discovered the Culinary Institute of America, which universally is known by its initials, CIA.
All right, so you were CIA before that other CIA.
We were. That's exactly right. They started, the Central Intelligence Agency is 1947, Culinary Institute of America, 1946. And so I went to the CIA as a student and then went to France and ended up working for Paul Bocuse and came back to Pittsburgh and we opened a restaurant called La Normande.
Right.
Which I think some people still remember.
I do.
And kind of the rest is history. At La Normande, I met a guy, Ferdinand Metz, who was in charge of research and development at H.J. Heinz Corporation. And then he ended up to become the president of the CIA, Culinary Institute of America. And I was his first draft pick. So he recruited me to come there. I thought it was going to be an interesting thing that I would do for a couple years. And that was 37 years ago.
Well, many people, of course, remember La Normande. I remember it. I took my future wife there to impress her.
Oh.
And I guess she was because she became my wife later on.
There you go.
So, but
magic.
When you started, you mentioned when you started, did you, you started like a lot of people in the restaurant industry washing dishes?
I started washing dishes, yeah.
So how did that transfer into this interest? I want to get involved. I see what's happening, maybe the magic in the kitchen.
Well, that's a good question. You know, I was a teenage boy, and washing dishes in this restaurant. You got to run a machine, you squirted stuff, and you watched this theater of the kitchen, flames and knives and all this activity, and it was kind of fascinating. And so I was enchanted by it. I got paid in cash. I was like a poor kid from Pittsburgh, from East Liberty, and got paid in cash and got a steak dinner at the end of the night. I said, wow, this is for me. My family, you know, back in those days probably had steak two times a year.
Right.
So that was, we had a lot of ground meat and city chicken on occasion.
Pittsburgh delicacy,
exactly.
City chicken.
I still make it at home, by the way.
You attended the institution that you're now president of. So at that time,
yeah.
When you were still, what were they looking for in a future chef when you enrolled?
Well, you know, there's been some books written about it recently, about that whole era, and how many young people, myself included, in the 70s were drawn to the profession and went to the CIA, revolutionized the world of food. There's an interesting book. I'll tell you the title. It's called Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll. And it's kind of the story of the American food revolution. And I'm typical of that story, no drugs. But
okay.
Young kid goes to, from a working class background, goes to the CIA, becomes enchanted with France and what was happening there, goes to France, comes back, and good things happen. And that's my story.
You mentioned being executive chef of La Normande. I believe you traveled France in preparation for the opening of that restaurant.
Yeah.
I'd like to ask you, has the influence of French cuisine changed on American restaurants over the years?
Yeah, definitely. And I think that the CIA has had a lot to do with that. Back in the 70s, in particular 60s and 70s, France was the epicenter of the culinary world. All the inspiration, all the innovation came from there. And today, it's really the rest of the world. And by the way, you know, the most innovative, interesting food country in the world is the United States of America. We have more new things, more innovation, more greatness happening in our restaurant industry here than anywhere else in the world. We're the envy of the world. But there's so many other influences. And just take a look at Pittsburgh. You know, back in the 70s, you were around back then. You were little, but, you know, it was Italian restaurants, right. Basically the same menus. It was a universal Pittsburgh menu. We could both recite it right now. And now there's Indian and Thai and Vietnamese and Japanese, and there's Italian. But, I mean, there's all these international flavors, these global flavors. And, you know, France has lost its grip on the culinary world. And
did they admit that?
They in recent years they have admitted it, but they don't like it. Okay. Who would?
When you were, I believe it was 27, you were the youngest chef to ever receive a Master Chef certification.
Right.
So, how do you at the Institute inspire young chefs to reach that kind of accomplishment?
Well, happily at the CIA, the students that come there are very self-motivated. So they already have their own dreams and aspirations, and we try to nurture that. One of the great things about the world of food, which, by the way, is the largest industry in the world, and people sometimes don't really understand that, but I always give them the results of our research. And our research shows that 100% of the world eats food. People always laugh at that. People always laugh at that. But if you think about it, there's no other product in the world that has that that trait. And so there's so many avenues that young people can pursue. There's so much opportunity. And we just try to nurture that.
Mm-hmm. How is the curriculum at the Culinary Institute changed from the time you were a student to now under your leadership? You have to be, I assume, responsive to all these new influences on our culture, on our country, and therefore on our food?
Well, we try not only to be responsive, but we try to be a leader of those changes. I think the world's best academic institutions, that's what they do. They're at the forefront of those changes, and that's what the CIA has been. So we mentioned kind of the international perspective of the culinary arts. So in the 70s, the CIA was very much focused on France.
Right.
And under my leadership, one of the things we definitely tried to do was to be much more global. We've got a campus in Singapore focused on the Asian market and Asian cuisines. We've got a campus in San Antonio, Texas, focused on Mexico and South America. And we're about to open a campus this month, in fact, in Barcelona, Spain. So that international perspective, those international flavors are really important, and that's one of the big changes. Beyond that, the restaurant industry in particular has become much more of a sophisticated business.
Right.
So we've added a lot more business to the curriculum because you can be the world's best chef, and if you lose money, you're not going to be a practitioner for very long. So you have to understand the business aspects of it. Mm-hmm. So much more complicated today. So those are some of the ways we've changed.
You mentioned Asia. You mentioned Singapore campus.
Yep.
Why that location for Asia, if you would, a campus in Asia?
Well, we strategically were interested in Asia because of the rise of Asia economically, its importance as a culinary power, and also its economic rise. So we were looking around Asia. And the government of Singapore came to us and said, we want to grow tourism in Singapore. It's an international banking center. They really didn't have restaurants. They had these hawker stalls, mm-hmm. you know, these little mom and pop kind of things, outdoors, no real restaurants outside of hotels. So about 10 years ago, we opened a campus there, and it's really helped to put Singapore on the food map. Mm-hmm. One of the things we found about Singapore that was attractive was, first of all, Singapore is kind of run like a corporation. They're very organized, and they've been good partners. If you do what you're supposed to do, they'll do what they're supposed to do. But the national language is English. Everybody in Singapore speaks English, so it made it so much easier for us to go to an Asian country where the language was English. There is no other like that.
Where do you get your students? I mean, obviously, United States, but do you get students from around the world as well? And I'm not talking about Singapore. I'm talking about coming to the U.S. and your campuses here.
Yeah, we have students from all 50 states in the U.S. and about 45 foreign nations. The number one, this is interesting, the number one nation, and we do no international marketing at all, is Korea.
Hmm.
About 20 years ago, the son of the president of the Korean Restaurant Association came to the CIA, went back to Korea, became an enormous success, and we've had a steady stream of Korean students.
What about What about France? I mean, you went to France as a young chef wanting to learn. Any chance it's happened the reverse?
Well, absolutely. It has. In fact, so I wanted to go to France to work for the legendary Paul Bocuse, the most important chef in history. He passed away right around this time last year. I was at his funeral. His son went to the CIA, Jerome. Who is still a good friend. And a lot of those legendary chefs of that era of France ended up to send their kids to the Culinary Institute of America. So it's an interesting turnabout.
Something you must be proud of, though.
Very proud. Very proud.
Mm-hmm. So I want to ask you about the difference in the curriculum. Mention how it's changed through the years from when you were a student to now under your leadership. But are there basics in the curriculum, whether the campus is in New York or San Antonio or Napa Valley or Singapore or coming up in Barcelona? Are there some universals?
Yes, there are. There's a set of basic fundamentals that wherever we are, we're teaching. And these are the basics of cooking. So you have to know how to hold a knife before you can sharpen it, before you can cut an onion. You have to cut an onion before you can make a stock. You have to make a stock before you can make a soup, and so on. There's a progression. And that sounds easy, but it's kind of like the old story of the great symphony played by the high school band and then played by the Pittsburgh Philharmonic. It's a different it's a different thing. Same set of notes, but in the hands of people that are really, really expert, it means a lot more. So we teach those basics, but our faculty are really, really expert and really, really help young people to master those basic fundamentals. We also have a set of core values that are important, and again, that seems easy. So at the top of the list is a culture of excellence. But after 70 years, it's something that really rings true and permeates our student body.
I want to ask you about technology. In the service industry, particularly in the schools, restaurants, I think of a chef's work as personal, as hands-on. And yet, how can technology be a chef's friend?
Well, in two ways. Right now in the restaurant industry in America, there are a million shortages in terms of jobs, a million jobs to be filled. So as we automate and apply technology to the industry, we're not replacing jobs, but we're helping to the industry to grow. And you'll be interested to learn, or maybe our listeners will be interested to learn, that CIA has a partnership with Carnegie Mellon University right here in Pittsburgh, across from my high school, Central Catholic. Hello, Central Catholic. And to develop robots that can do what chefs do today. Now, that said, and as advanced as the technology is, that's still years away. What a human can do. Well, let me give a kind of a metaphorical example. If people know who Elon Musk is and what he's been trying to do at Tesla, he famously recently had a factory 100% robots, and they ended up taking 30% of the robots out. And here's what he said: "It turns out that humans are underrated." Mm-hmm. So as simple as dicing an onion, or even washing dishes, seems to be. Robots cannot yet do that. That's a level of sophistication that people can do fairly easily, but robots cannot do. So that's what we're working with CMU on.
Right. Just a couple minutes left. You're in town to be honored as one of the 50 greatest Pittsburghers of all time, a list that includes the likes of Rachel Carson, Fred Rogers, Jonas Salk, Andrew Carnegie, and others as selected by Pittsburgh Magazine. As you look back, how would you say Pittsburgh has influenced your work?
The older I get, the more I see how Pittsburgh. I mean, I've always loved Pittsburgh. Pittsburghers love Pittsburgh, even when we move away. And there's just something special here. I don't know what it is, but there's a certain set of values, hard work, set of humility, standard of humility, that we just focus on trying to get better, trying to do a great job, sticking to business. I'm not sure what it is, but I think about Pittsburgh every day, and I feel very blessed and fortunate to have been born here. Everybody who knows me within the first, 3 minutes that they meet me, they know I'm from Pittsburgh. Because I'll bring it up. I'll talk about it. I'll ask them where they're at. And oftentimes they're from Pittsburgh, too. So we have a lot in common.
All right. So as a chef, as a trainer of chefs, what sort of legacy do you hope to one day in the distant, distant future leave behind?
Well, that in my lifetime already, and I'm far from done, America went from being an also-ran in the world of food to the envy of the world. And that's a fabulous legacy for us.
So we, in a sense, we were consumer, if you would, of other people's food, other people's food traditions. Now we're an innovator?
Totally. We were a hamburger and hot dog nation. And we're still that. And, you know, we're proud to export hamburgers and hot dogs all over the world. But now we are the innovator and the most dynamic restaurant industry in the world.
Tim Ryan is president of the Culinary Institute of America. Tim, thanks so much for being here today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Kevin Gavin, and you're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Megan Harris. The Confluence airs live from 9 to 10 a.m., but the news never stops. Find more stories, conversations, and more on our website at wesa.fm/confluence, on Twitter at WESAConfluence, and wherever you get your podcasts. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, Pittsburgh City Council adopts an ordinance that begins municipal recycling in 1990. The local law was in compliance with the state and was a single-stream system, meaning all the discarded items were mixed together for curb collection. Mayor Sophie Maslow was leading the city's blue bag efforts at the time, which was estimated to save the city thousands of dollars in landfill costs. Now the blue bags are falling out of favor and community organizations have been distributing large blue bins for recycling. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
WESA celebrates 90 neighborhoods, 90 good stories, a weekly series about people who make the place they live a better place to live. Made possible with support from UPMC, life-changing medicine.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's been more than a decade since a Staten Heights man, along with his family, created the AR3 Foundation to honor the brother he lost to gun violence. Jason Rivers now says he's pursuing a deeper healing through forgiveness and restorative justice. Rivers talked to 90.5 WESA's Elaine Effort about his journey since the murder of his brother, Anthony.
Losing my brother to gun violence and watching what that did to my family, you know, to my mother, to my other siblings, my brother's children, and, you know, all those people that loved him. It was heartbreaking. There was a large part in the beginning where I was broken and wanted to hurt myself and hurt somebody else. And in all those ways, I'm grateful for the handful of people that were around that fought for me when I didn't see hope anymore. And the way that I fight this fight is through educating people on the source of violence and what ways can I be a part of a restorative process for self and for community through this process of seeking to figure out what forgiveness could look like for me. What healing could look like for me. I knew that there would be a time and a place where I would want to interact with the individuals that were involved in the situation. And so this journey.
Why was that important? Why is it important to meet face-to-face and advocate for your brother's killer?
Yeah. The reason why it's important is because there's there's multiple perspectives to every story, every truth. And understanding was a part of that journey. Like, I needed to understand why. I needed to understand, what situations could occur in an individual's life that could lead them to produce an act such as this. And so for me, that desire of, and it's always been a part of who I am and the work that I've done in regards to community. So it was more natural. It's just painful because it's tied to something close to me. But I knew that part of my own healing would be needed to release that sort of pain and resentment, because that stuff eats away at you. The goal is to really understand what does justice even look like, and are we really getting justice from this judicial system in the way that it's set up? Because the way I see it, violence hasn't stopped. You know, the issues, the social ills in our community are still there. So if long prison sentences fixed anything, we wouldn't be having these problems. And so my goal is, you know, there has to be an adaptive way that we look at this work. And that's my desire. And that was the reason why I went to go visit that young man and build relationship with him. And I'm beginning to work with other family members who have had similar experiences of mine.
Thank you very much for taking time to do this interview, Jason Rivers.
Thank you very much for having me.
Share your suggestion for our series WESA Celebrates 90 Neighborhoods, 90 Good Stories at WESA.FM/90. Made possible with support from UPMC, life-changing medicine.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris. In October, four members of the Pagans Motorcycle Club were charged with aggravated assault, conspiracy, and riot after getting into a bar fight involving alcohol with undercover police officers in the South Side. Those charges were ultimately withdrawn, but now the city's police bureau is conducting an internal investigation into the policies around drinking while undercover. Liz Reed is an editor and reporter here at WESA, and she's been looking into that policy. She joins me now. Liz, welcome.
Thank you, Megan.
So, Liz, what is the current drinking policy for undercover officers?
Well, that's the big question that we just don't know. So I submitted a right to know request. This is how you know, anyone, including journalists, can get public records.
Of course.
And I was asking for records reflecting the policy and any training materials related to it. That request was ultimately denied because, according to the city's open records officer, the records do not exist. They're not required to create records for the requester. So that suggests that if there is any policy, it's not written down either on paper or digitally. Now, when I asked the police department to confirm this, I didn't get a strong yes or no answer. What they said was that they're investigating the existing policies for the undercover program and looking at the need for additional policies.
So from what we can tell, should they have a policy? How important is that for undercover work, knowing what's okay, what requires approval from a supervisor, and maybe what you can never do?
Well, whether or not they should have a policy and what that policy should look like really depends on who you ask. So I talked to a former FBI agent and La Roche College professor. His name's Bill Crowley. He said it's extremely difficult to create very specific policies for undercover work because of the fluid nature of this work. Officers have to be able to adapt to a situation in order to, you know, A, not blow their cover, and B, not compromise their safety. I also talked to a Seton Hill criminal justice professor. Her name's Siobhan Arthurs, and she told me that it's very common for departments not to have a policy about drinking while undercover, though she says she does know of some departments that specify a 2-drink maximum. And neither she nor the former FBI agent were big fans of this approach because it doesn't give undercover officers enough discretion. However, they did advocate for a decision-making framework. So a policy that might not necessarily speak specifically to the use of alcohol or drugs while undercover, but could guide officers in making good decisions. Here's Siobhan Arthurs talking about that.
You could have training strategies in place for officers, like what do you do when you're in a bar? Because a watering hole, a bar, when you're undercover work, when you're dealing with drugs, alcohol spots are going to be a large part of what you're doing.
And we know other outlets have reported that those undercover officers in Copies were investigating a drug complaint.
Now, Copies Bar being on the South Side where this altercation occurred.
Right, yes, at Copies Bar. Now, at the FBI, for example, they specifically choose agents who have a track record of good decision making for undercover work. And then they provide them with even more training on how to make good decisions on the fly. And
let's back up first. What is undercover work? Like, when does that come up? What types of investigations might that include? And how do officers get involved with that at all?
So, I mean, there are different types of undercover work depending on what agency you're with and what you're doing. It's generally something that people volunteer for. There's no like requirement that you do undercover work.
A special assignment.
Right. And so at the FBI, there are people who might go undercover for years, assume false identities, live apart from their families, and really ingrain themselves in a criminal underground.
You know, is that something that you would do on the Pittsburgh level?
It's possible. I think it probably varies from department to department, and it probably varies as an investigation warrants. But, you know, think about that movie Donnie Brasco. That was based on a real story where an FBI agent named Joseph Pistone posed as a jewelry thief for years to bring down a mafia family. And then, you know, even within the FBI, there's smaller bit parts. The former FBI agent Bill Crowley told me he called them cameos. He said he himself had done them. So you might play a bit part in another investigation. And, you know, and locally, the gigs would vary widely as well, and depending on what you're investigating, for example, if you're investigating drugs, that might involve you hanging out in places where people drink, according to my sources. So it might look weird if you're in a bar for 5 hours but don't drink.
Do they have strategies in place for staying sober, maybe while appearing to keep pace with your company at a bar?
Yeah, so Siobhan Arthur's made some specific suggestions to me. Officers could tell the bartender what they're doing there and say, you know, when I order a gin and tonic, I'm only asking for the tonic and the lime so that it looks like an alcoholic drink, but it's not. Or they can order beer in cans so they can nurse one for hours and no one will be able to tell how much beer they have left.
How does this non-policy compare to what maybe other jurisdictions or other agencies require, or can we tell at this point?
Yeah, I mean, it does vary widely. I mean, like I said, some law enforcement agencies might have a two-drink maximum. The FBI has a robust, training protocol, a decision-making framework. It really just depends on the agency. I will say the Pennsylvania State Police said that they do have a policy, but they didn't want to release it to me for reasons of public safety. They wouldn't want people they're investigating to know what that policy is.
So we mentioned that the charges were dropped against these four members of the Pagan Motorcycle Club. Is there anything else happening with this case at this point?
Well, I will say, so the charges were dropped, but the DA said he does reserve the right to reintroduce the charges. And the officers are still being investigated. The incident itself is still being investigated, both internally by the police department and externally by the city's Office of Municipal Investigations.
Are the Pittsburgh officers who were involved likely, from what we can tell right now, to receive any disciplinary action?
Well, they are currently on paid administrative leave pending the outcome of those investigations. And the city is being pretty tight-lipped about those investigations while they're ongoing. We also know the city is facing lawsuits from some of these motorcycle club members who say that the police officers instigated the entire fight in the bar. You know, what I can tell you is that I spoke with Robert Swartzwelder, the head of the Fraternal Order of Police, which is the union that represents officers. Mm-hmm. And he says that if the city truly does not have any policy, then they have no grounds to discipline the officers.
Liz Reed is an editor at 90.5 WESA. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Happy to do it.
I'm Megan Harris. You're listening to The Confluence.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Wolf administration has announced the largest reduction in the number of inmates in the Pennsylvania state prison system since such records began being kept. In 2018, there was a decrease in the population by 1,068 prisoners. That's 2.2%, and it's the seventh drop in 8 years. I spoke recently about the reasons for the decline with the Secretary of the Department of Corrections, John Wetzel. What do you cite as the main factors for this decline?
Yeah, I think it's really threefold. I think, one, we passed the Justice Reinvestment Initiative in 2012. We're really starting to see the benefits of doing a better job at targeting who needs to come to state prison. Number two, really doing a hard look internally and focusing on being more efficient. You know, last year the governor signed an executive order that combined the field supervision aspect of probation and parole under corrections. You've seen a huge reduction in population. And number three, we've had less people get sent from counties. So we've gotten less commitments from courts. Some of that is because the notice mandatories, especially drug mandatories, were thrown out by the Supreme Court. So we're seeing some benefit of that. But all this happens in the context of crime being lower at the same time.
You're saying fewer people from the county jails. So is that due to shorter sentences? Because I know a lot of county jails handle prisoners who have been convicted, but up to a certain length of a sentence.
Yeah, I think what we're seeing is just less people coming from county. So I think the number is about 600-ish less new commits from counties. Now, what drug mandatories did is, in my opinion, over-incarcerated, so had more people coming to state prison than needed to be. I think by giving the judges the discretion in making that decision, frankly, they're making better decisions. They're keeping people who don't need to be in a state prison out of a state prison.
What about recidivism? Have you noticed a decline in inmates getting back into the system, and so therefore the overall population is not as great?
We don't have the recidivism numbers yet in for this year, for 2018. So stay tuned to that. We've seen drop some years and a slight increase other years. One of the things that's really a challenge to our recidivism numbers are the opioid epidemic. So we certainly are having more people get addicted to opioids, especially parolees. So stay tuned for that. We should have those numbers hopefully halfway through next year.
There's been a lot of talk about criminal justice reform. We have heard it at the federal level. We've heard it from the Wolf administration. We're hearing it here in the Pittsburgh area. What role, and one of those elements we keep hearing, shorter sentences, what role would that play in the consequently in the overall prison population?
Yeah, it would be huge. And I think just to contextualize a little more, shorter sentences, when that makes sense, when that's a good decision. Certainly, one of the new group we're seeing come into the criminal justice system are people getting addicted to opioids who don't have a long criminal history, but have committed a bunch of crimes as a byproduct of their addiction. That's a group that would actually likely get worse if they were sent to a state prison. So those are groups, and you're in Allegheny County, probably the epicenter of specialty courts. You know, you have a veterans court out there, probably one of the best in the country. You have drug courts, treatment courts. So I think what we're seeing is systems like Allegheny County getting smarter in their response to crime and realizing that prison or jail doesn't necessarily have to be the answer. If we can ensure public safety and divert people and get them the treatment they need to address the root cause of the crime so they're less likely to commit a crime, that's a good public safety practice. And as important, it saves us money. Incarceration at the state level costs us $42,000 a year per person.
Let me follow up on the money savings, and that is, what does this reduction in overall inmate population allow you to do in terms of the ability to care for the remaining 47,000 inmates?
Yeah, well, certainly when we have less inmates, that makes more program beds available, makes more seats in our classrooms available, so that's a benefit. We've also seen a reduction in our supervised population, and it's allowing us to do things on the field supervision aspect to set people coming out of prison more up for success. We have a pilot going on with the White House called Safe Streets. Allegheny County is one of the counties that is participating in that. And it's really focusing on good reentry for people coming out of prison. We're partnering with workforce agencies and all this stuff. When we have less a burden on the system can perform in a much better and smarter way that will ultimately get us more outcomes.
The drop in population, more than 1,000, will we ever have huge drops, huge decreases until the legislative, executive, and judicial branches sort of grapple with the question of long-term sentences?
Yeah, absolutely. That's got to be a piece of the discussion. And I think we started to see some discussion around that. I know Governor Wolf has championed over the past 2 years, actually 4 years, the Justice Reinvestment Initiative, another justice reinvestment that focuses on right-sizing prison population, making better decisions, sending less people who don't need to be in state prison there. There's also been some discussion about some of our longer-term sentences. There was some legislation introduced this year that spawned some discussions looking at life without parole. Pennsylvania is a state where life means life. And Pennsylvania is also a state where you can commit felony murder, so second-degree murder, not be the trigger person, and still get life, which is rather unusual. So I think these are all things that we're going to have to grapple with as we continue to move forward.
I wanted to ask you about the makeup of the prison population and even the reduction in the number of inmates. Was that reduction also reflective in terms of the racial makeup, the percentage of prisoners in the state system? The ratio of blacks versus whites is, I believe, somewhere in the neighborhood of more than 3-1. What about the decline in the number of African Americans in prison?
Yeah, actually, over 100% of our population reduction is represented in the non-white population. So it's an absolute fact that our system got more fair and less disparate. But anytime you hear Governor Wolf talking about criminal justice reform, he talks about a system that's more just. And what with this population reduction, as well as the population reduction over the past 6-7 years now, we've seen our population get less disparate, although there's still a huge disparity. I think it's closer to 4-1. I think about 12% of the population of Pennsylvania is black, and I think it used to be 48%, but it's still above 45% of our prison population is black. So there's still a huge disparity, but it's less disparate.
Is there any sense that that disparity is due to longer sentences for African Americans?
So I think we certainly do see disparity in outcome, and there's probably a bunch of factors. One, you know, people who lived in impoverished areas are more likely to get longer sentences for the same crime. One of the things in Pennsylvania that's very unique and not in a good way is that Pennsylvania is the only state that does not fund indigent defense. So the people who are the poorest arguably don't get the same representation as people who have more assets. And again, Pennsylvania is the only state to do that. Allegheny County is pretty fortunate that they have a good public defense system, but that's not the case all over the Commonwealth. And that's a huge contributing factor to disparity in our system, in my opinion.
And as a consequence, maybe a lesser quality defense, more of a chance for a longer prison sentence for the same crime, if you would.
Absolutely. Not to mention another big push of the governor during his second term is going to be bail reform. And we know that people who bail out serve shorter sentences and are less likely to ultimately receive a state sentence than those who don't bail out. But currently in most of our counties, we use money as a proxy for bail. We're not making bail decisions based on risk. We're making it based on money. And so indigent people are more likely to stay incarcerated pretrial and ultimately more likely to serve more time for the same offense. So bail reform is absolutely a key part of the governor's next term.
All right, if you were to make a prediction, would you say next year, if we're talking at this time, we will see a similar drop in the prison population, a greater drop? And if so, why so?
I hope so. How about that for hedging your bet? I think a lot of the factors that were present this year that drove the population down are still present. I hope we continue to move forward in this manner. But the thing about criminal justice is that sometimes one event triggers significant change to our population. 2009, a parolee got out, killed a police officer in Philadelphia, which is obviously a horrible event. Governor Rendell shut down parole. That caused an increase in our population at 2,500 inmates within 2 years. So these one-off events oftentimes trigger huge moves in the population. Hopefully we're more evolved in that. Hopefully we're in a better place in that. And hopefully I'll be talking to you next year with another significant reduction in both prison population and crime.
That's John Wetzel, Secretary of the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections. And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, he's been a freedom rider, a civil rights activist riding interstate buses in the segregated South. He's been a Pittsburgh counselor, a community leader, and a school board member. We'll meet Salah Uddin. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Meg Fair, plus Mick Stanelli, Joya Zenkovich, and Alex Lenigan. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.